The magazine of today and tomorrow is on the air. Today we present another of a series of broadcasts under the general title, America's Interesting People. Our speaker is Mr. Sumner Blossom, editor of the American Magazine, whose business it is to know all there is to know about the personalities of the day. He comes to us for 15 minutes to give us a cross-section of the amazingly interesting people whom he meets on his daily job. His talks portray what makes a magazine great, for a magazine builds its personality out of the people it writes about. As we listen to these intimate talks from Mr. Blossom, we begin to feel that we know him pretty well, and that we are sharing all the thrills and excitement of his life as an eminent editor. Mr. Blossom.
How do you do? Whenever I see the names of Helen Wills Moody and Helen Jacobs in the newspapers, I think of a 70-year-old Californian, Pop Fuller of Berkeley, one of the most important and interesting men in international sports. Strangely enough, he's never been much in the public eye. Yet W.C. Fuller has been coaching girl tennis players for years, and most of these girls have batted their way to fame with their rackets. It might be a coincidence if a coach turned out two such stars as the pair of California Helens, but when all of his pupils become stars, you'd better look him over, and look him over closely. There's something there. The reason you never heard of Pop Fuller, if you haven't, is that he took up coaching for the love of the game, not for fame, not for money, and not for publicity. For years, he's only had two interests in his life, art and tennis. He collects art and is a volunteer coach at the Berkeley Tennis Club. When Helen Wills became the greatest champion of all time, Pop Fuller was old enough, by ordinary standards, to quit coaching and bask in the reflected glory. But he didn't. He went right along finding new little girls in pigtails who were playing good tennis on public courts. He took them in hand and made champions and near champions of them. Helen Jacobs was one of these. And today he is training Ann Morgan, left-handed and only 14 years old, to take the throne that one of the Helens will someday vacate. Pop says Ann is a better player for her age than were either of them. It may seem strange that the king of coaches should give all of his time to training girls. The truth of the matter is that Pop Fuller thinks tennis is a girl's sport. For a few years he tried to train boys, but he gave them up. They wouldn't concentrate on the game and went in for too many other sports, and worst of all, refused to give Pop their complete faith. But girls believe in him, worship him, as if he were a high priest of a religion. And then they're more sporting, too, he says. And by the way, Pop Fuller tells me that while men players have criticized linesmen and ball boys, barking dogs, and spectators, Helen Wills Moody has never voiced a complaint, on or off the courts, about a match. But Pop knows that when Helen's fingers are spread out on a racket, she is upset, and when her fingers are close together, all is well. Pop indicates to me also that the stories of a grudge between Helen Wills Moody and Helen Jacobs are bunk. He says that the rivalry has been intense, but there never has been a harsh word or the slightest bitterness between them. Strange as it may seem, Pop Fuller, who has brought dozens of players to fame, never held a tennis racket in his hand while he's training a player. Fearful of influencing individual style, he contents himself by tossing the balls. And stranger still, Pop Fuller has never held a racket in his hand at all until he was 40 years old. Now, girls may prove themselves eventually to be better aviators as well as better tennis players. Helen Ritchie, for example, has already flown to stardom. At the age of 25, she is the only woman air mail pilot in America. She can do more than the average air mail pilot can do, too. She can bake good biscuits, and she can fly a plane. Helen's father, J.B. Ritchie, superintendent of schools in McKeesport, Pennsylvania, planned a teaching career for his daughter. But a trip to Cleveland as a passenger in an airplane spoiled that idea. Back home, Helen began making model planes and studying the theory of aerodynamics and aeronautics. And then she went to Carnegie Tech, where she studied more. And in the next 5 years, she accumulated 1,000 hours of solo flying. Then she established a woman's endurance record and got a job flying the air mail. Right now, this very attractive girl is flying the mail on a regular run between Washington, D.C. and Detroit. Her contract has only one peculiar clause in it. She can't get married, at least not yet a while. They don't want a man around interrupting the mail service, it seems. It wasn't so very many years ago that men expected nothing of women except perhaps a pleasing personality or good looks. The word interesting was applied only to women of exceptional beauty or vivacity. Things have changed considerably since then. A woman is interesting now for the same reasons that a man is: intelligence and character. Gloria Hollister, another youngster of 25, began to become interesting when she was only 3 years old. Her parents recall that she made herself a nuisance at their home in Suffern, New York, by dragging in snakes and frogs and lizards. When Gloria was a bit older, she began to grow tired of the exteriors of her captives and began to dissect them. And today, Gloria Hollister is the champion woman depth diver of the world. She's the right-hand man to Dr. William Beebe, the famous explorer of the deep seas. She goes down in a special diving bell, but to explore the ocean's floor and to study deep sea fish. Her research has won high honors and a permanent job for her with the New York Zoological Society. She has a lot of other interests, too, this Hollister girl. She collects moths and wire-haired terriers and South American beadwork. She rides a blue ribbon show horse and is proud of her brood of naked-necked chickens, a species of Orpington. And when she's not otherwise busy, Miss Hollister makes glass fish in her private laboratory in New York City. That is, she takes ordinary fish and makes them transparent by a process of her own, so that you can see their bones. She colors the spines red, and thus far she's produced about 3,000 transparent fish with red backbones. And then there's Mary Hirsch, 22-year-old graduate of Marymount College at Tarrytown, New York. She's the only woman in the world who is a licensed horse trainer. She trains horses for Bernard Baruch and Herbert Bayard Swope, and Mrs. Vanderbilt, and many others who can afford fine stables. As a small girl, she watched the morning workouts at her father's stable. He was Max Hirsch, himself a famous trainer. When Mary went away to a finishing school, she bolted the campus every weekend to be with her horses. An old horseman told her that training wasn't any job for a girl. But when she took it up professionally, they shrugged her shoulders and laughed and said it couldn't be done. But now they'll tell you that she can speak horse language. Now, certainly it is that she understands what every neigh and every whinny means. Miss Hirsch and I, by the way, disagree on at least one subject. She believes that horses have more intelligence than dogs. Well, maybe so, and maybe not. And the Woman's Knitting Brigade probably will be interested in hearing about Mrs. Rose R. Rice of Los Angeles, California. Miss Rice, an inveterate knitter, found yarn pretty expensive, and so she solved her problem with Angora rabbits. She raises the rabbits, clips their fur, spins it into yarn, and then crochets their yarn into sweaters. And she sells the sweaters. That's a business and a hobby combined. She started out with only 5 rabbits, and now she's clipping 100 rabbits in rotation. Miss Adeline McKnight, a 21-year-old co-ed like Mrs. Rice, has returned to an ancient occupation. Miss McKnight actually is working her way through Kent College at Kent, Ohio, as a cobbler. Twice her work has received honors at the National Shoe Exposition. But let's see if we haven't a man or two on today's program. Yes, here's Harold G. Hoffman, governor of New Jersey. He's 39 years old, a vigorous, stockily built chap, and always in action. He's a Republican and was elected in a Democratic year. He's the third governor of his political faith to hold office in his state in the last 27 years. And he's one of 8 Republican governors in the United States today. New Jersey, crisscrossed with traffic from New York to Philadelphia and Washington, and with traffic between New York and the Middle West, has a problem which is practically a national affair. Governor Hoffman was motor vehicle commissioner of New Jersey for 5 years and is credited with doing more to cut down the motor car death toll than any other one man. As governor, he's carrying on his crusade. He tells me that 85% of motor car accidents today are caused by mile-a-minute men who drive at a higher rate of speed than is safe. 61% of all motor car deaths in the last 3 years were on perfectly straight highways or between intersections, and 85% of them were on clear days. Governor Hoffman particularly dislikes those who say they can stop their car on a dime. He says that it takes 3/4 of a second to make up your mind to put your foot on the brake. In that time, if the car is going 60 miles an hour, you travel 66 feet. 66 feet in an emergency, remember, and you haven't even put your foot on the brake. And then after you brake the car, it travels 160 feet before it stops. Governor Hoffman can sit up all night quoting interesting facts about driving, and when he isn't attending to the other affairs of his state, you're pretty apt to find him out on the road studying actual traffic conditions. And then there's Joseph Lance, who started out as a pharmacist and ended up as a famous clothing designer. 12 years ago, a lad of 18, Lance was a registered pharmacist in an Austrian drugstore. He was attracted by the picturesque colors of peasant costumes, and was inspired to design some sporting clothes of similar hue and patterns. And he sold these clothes and sold them freely. The Prince of Wales and other European celebrities patronized him. This year he brought his peasant costumes to America and set a new style in men and women's sportswear. You know, that young man interests me. If he hadn't been an unusual person, he probably would still be making pills in Austria. But he had an eye for opportunity, and opportunity is around us all. It's there for the sharp eye to see it, and it's there for the bold heart to use it. Thousands of tourists had seen those peasant costumes, including designers and artists and mill executives and sportswear experts, and they did nothing about them. Only today, a young man complained to me that the frontiers of opportunity are closed to youth. I told him of Joe Lance, and I told him of Jack Hamill, a former prize fighter who has pushed back the frontiers of America. Jack Hamill is one fighter who knows that a fight for a fight's sake is a waste of valuable energy and intelligence. It's like a steam locomotive without any cars to pull. The thing that makes Jack Hamill one of the most interesting men on the continent today is the fact that his fighting has a meaning. Civilization moved through the breach that he made with his fists. More than 40 years ago, Jack Hamill was a knockabout Irish boy from Beaton, Ontario, drifting from prize ring to prize ring. He was well set up, had a pugnacious jaw, was fast on his feet, and swung a left like lead on wings. He fought in the ring in almost every city in America until it suddenly occurred to him that a fight without a purpose was a waste of energy and of time. It was years before Jack Hamill got a chance to use his fists for a cause. Then one day a mining company gave him a commission to move seven tough boys from a claim that they had jumped. Jack moved them out with his fists. One of the seven was a circus strongman who later came up tottering and asked Hamill for a job, and he got it. Jack Hamill got $5,000 for that fight and set out to prospect for himself. He followed the booms, found silver, and then moved on as a pioneer of North Canadian development. He borrowed a stake and organized a company to explore nearly 200,000 miles of unknown territory, from Quebec to the coast ranges and north to the Arctic Circle. Towns and small cities thrive now where Jack first made his way on snowshoes and on dog sled. In the last 10 years, the entire Canadian North has been open to prospectors and mining men, and Hamill, fighting Jack Hamill, former pugilist, is responsible. Thousands of men are employed in what for him might have still been a wilderness. He built railroads, used tractors, and was the first to use airplanes in the whole North Country. Jack Hamill is a millionaire today, a mining magnate, but still a fighter. His hobby is collecting fine paintings, and he has one of the best private collections in Canada. And many an art dealer knows him only as the man who always refers to Rembrandt as that guy. And when I think of the crash of falling timber and the sharp reports of breaking ice and the rattle of drills in the mines, I also think of the cracking of Jack Hamill's fists as he strode into the north, fighting for a purpose. And now, much as I regret it, I've come to the end of my time, and I must say goodbye.
You have just been listening to Mr. Sumner Blossom, editor of the American Magazine, whose comments on America's interesting personalities are based on the millions of words of news copy that passed through his hands in the publishing of a great modern magazine. Mr. Blossom will be with us again soon in another of these talks.